The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Sarah Weiss-Maudi, the expert on flotillas and maritime law for the Foreign Ministry of Israel. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish experts on the international scene, Tom Price, our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, and a new contributor, poet Liz Schallenberger. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reform Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's hot, really hot now, and officially summer starts this coming week, so it must be time to play the immortal, eternally entertaining cut from the late great comedian Alan Sherman about kids going off to summer camp where it's cooler. Here it is, an annual tradition on Two Jewish for the past nearly 9 years, believe it or not, the classic tune, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada.
Hello, Mudda. Hello, Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner. He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters. And the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies. So he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy. They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada. Take me home. I hate Granada. Don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home. I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mudda, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Mudda Fada, kindly disregard this letter.
There's something about summer camp that simply never changes. While Alan Sherman isn't talking about Jewish summer camp at his song, which is one of the best ways to try to make sure your children and grandchildren stay Jewish, he is describing an experience that so many of us have had, leaving home for cooler climates and different customs and traditions with a bunch of kids we never met before. And that homesickness he describes with great humor is a very real thing, and one we all overcame and had a great time, whether it was for a week or a summer or every summer. It's also time for vacations, and lots of us are heading out to enjoy the wide world outside of our home cities and towns. One of the great unsuspected pleasures of traveling is the chance to explore Jewish sites and living Jewish communities in far-flung places. I can assure you that we Jews have lived pretty much everywhere and have active synagogues in places you might never imagine. And it is always worthwhile and often surprisingly gratifying to go out and find Jewish communities to pray with or to meet people in or just to see the remarkable places we Jews have created in the far corners of the world. You can find Jewish communities almost everywhere you go. Well, maybe not so much in Antarctica or Fiji, but almost everywhere else. Look up Jewish travel online and just make sure you call ahead if you're going to a temple. In today's world, many of the places around the world do require advance information on who's coming in for security reasons, but it's worth taking the trouble. Today is Father's Day, clearly a hallmark faux festival if ever one existed. But since my family, under the direction of my very lovely wife Wendy, has done a fantastic job of celebrating this greeting card holiday with food and gifts and many hugs, here's a classic Yiddish song to Dad, an interesting pop jazz version of Oh My Papa, which Eddie Fisher made famous a very long time ago. This one sung by Eleanor Risa.
Oh, mein Papa. Er ist gewein, mein Malacho. Vorbei der Tag, wenn ich bin gesessen, lief sein Scheuß. In mit der Kisch verbitten meine Tränen mit
Oh, my papa. Yep, a Yiddish classic. Fathers are important figures in all cultures, but for Jews, the concept of the father has maybe a little extra importance. For example, the beginning of the central prayer in every service is the Avot, the prayer for the fathers, and it includes a text that praises God for being the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. From the time of the Talmud, at least 1,600 years ago, every Jewish service includes this central evocation of dads. Fathers are given special honor in other ways in Judaism. The Ten Commandments focus on honoring father and mother. The Gemara spends a long time debating whether the honor due your father is greater than the honor due to your teacher. I remember raising that question at a temple retreat on ethics, explaining that teachers, including but not limited to rabbis, are supposed to be shown great honor at all times, and of course so are fathers. So whom should you honor more, your father or your rabbi, I asked. My then 7-year-old son, he's the one who's now 15, Boaz, raised his hand, and I called on him for his analysis of this complex question. What if your father is also your rabbi, he asked, pretty much ending the discussion, everybody dissolving in laughter. We hear a lot about Jewish mothers in our culture, but not as much about Jewish fathers. Maybe that's a mistake. Although you know the famous joke, a boy comes home from school and says, Mom, I got a part in the school play. What's your role? She asks. I'm the Jewish father, he answers. You go back and tell the teacher you want a speaking part, his mother answers. But that's not really always how it works. Fathers play a central role in teaching sons and daughters about Judaism and morality, making the great traditions of our people meaningful and fresh in this and every generation. It's both the place of the father and his responsibility, and that's a really important part in any and every family, every mishpacha. So, Happy Father's Day. And may all you fathers out there get just what you want from your kids today, which for most of us is nothing tangible at all. It's the love of our children. And most of the time, their respect. When we return on Two Jewish, we'll talk with Sarah Weiss-Maudy, who might know more about maritime law and how it affects Israel when flotilla boats try to land on its shores than anybody else in the world. We'll learn just what it all means and how it works when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. Or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means... Nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org.
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Sarah Weiss-Maudy. She's a senior assistant to the legal advisor for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Jerusalem. That's the Misrad HaChutz, the ministry in charge of, well, all of the foreign issues that Israel deals with, which is so important to the country. We're going to talk about legal issues, in particular legal issues relating to the so-called flotilla and some of the upcoming legal issues that might exist. Can you briefly kind of introduce, by the way, Boker Tov, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about what international law says about blockading your own coast or blockading another person's coast.
Well, so that's the very thing. You don't blockade your own coast. A state has wide powers with regard to its territorial sea. But what happens is when you're in an armed conflict at sea with another state or with another entity, then that gives rise to the right to... there's various methods of warfare at sea, and one of the methods of warfare at sea would be the imposition of a naval blockade. Now, what that means, what a naval blockade is a tool that can be used at time of armed conflict. And when a naval blockade is in effect, no vessel, and that means neither enemy vessels nor neutral vessel, no vessel at all, can enter or exit the blockaded area.
So you basically can interdict an area if you're at war with the population, or we don't use the term at war anymore, apparently armed conflict with another population, another entity like, say, the Hamas, who are in control of Gaza, and you can stop any materials at all from getting in.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And a naval blockade can be imposed. There was a little bit of confusion about this last year when there was the incident in May 2010.
The Turkish flotilla with the Mavi Marmara issue.
A naval blockade can be imposed. It is usually imposed on international waters, right, because you have control over your territorial sea, and usually you give a broader scope just because vessels are moving forward. Now,
so we think of, you know, the British blockading the French Napoleonic Wars, or in World War I, the Germans, or something.
There are even modern examples of naval blockades. There's numerous examples. There are examples from the Vietnam War. There are examples from World War II. There are examples even recent times. There are also examples, some people have asked the question, can they be imposed in a non-international conflict? And indeed, there are historic examples. If you look at the U.S. Civil War, for example, that's a classic case of a...
The Anaconda plan of General Winfield Scott.
So that is something that can be used in both an international and non-international context. Now, we asked the question, why does Israel need a naval blockade off the coast of Gaza? What's the purpose of that? Here, we need to take into consideration, first of all, just in regular peacetime maritime commerce, about over 90% of trade goes through the sea. Unfortunately, we have terrorist organizations. We have the Hamas, a terrorist organization that is a terrorist organization both under U.S. law, under European law. It is an organization that does not subscribe to the Quartet principles. Those are the principles that say that to recognize the State of Israel's right to exist in any configuration, to accept existing principles, existing agreements with Israel, and to renounce violence. Hamas does not do any of those things. And one of the tools that Israel has at its disposal, again, one of the legal tools Israel has at its disposal, to block weapons from coming in via the sea to the Gaza Strip is the blockade. It essentially seals off the Gaza Strip from maritime commerce. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that actually Gaza doesn't have a seaport. So in terms of questions of would this be proportionate with this imposing a blockade, again, Gaza never depended on maritime commerce. Really, the maritime arena is used essentially for smuggling in weaponry. And we have lots of examples of that from recent times, starting with the Karine A incident, where 50 tons of weapons were smuggled in.
And taken by Israel and demonstrated to the world.
Yeah, and we had just recently in, I think it's March, we had the Victoria incident, again, where another 50 tons of weapons were intercepted at sea, going straight to terrorist organizations in the Gaza Strip. And so Israel tries to think of ways, grapples with the questions, like any democracy fighting terrorism, what legal tools are at its disposal, and one of these tools is the maritime blockade.
All right, we will talk much more extensively about what the rules are, not only for maritime blockade, but for interdicting weapons and other materials going into an enemy state that you have control of its borders, when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too. Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grand, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also download our podcast from the Apple iTunes Store or go to the website and just listen, twojewishradio.com. We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a randomly recurring feature of Two Jewish, Zen Judaism. To find serenity, you must be serene. To find peace, you must be peaceful. To find bargains, you must shop. Those were koans on Zen Judaism. We welcome our pretty darn new contributor, poet Liz Schallenberger.
Thank you, Rabbi. This is called Rabbi. This dervish whirls with kippah and tallit, quick hands on the blackberry. He circles the candles like Moses seeking the tail end of his people. We watch and we listen, we sing, we laugh at his jokes. This bearded uncle, this clever brother, this father of ours, he leads and we follow. And I dream in the sanctuary and worry, does our Avraham, our Yitzhak, our Shmuel, does he carry our sins? Does he sleep? At night, does he lie down upon the bima and pray while we eat challah and drink our Mad Dog 2020?
It's a great poem. Thank you, Liz. I don't know what that rabbi is you're talking about, though.
Me neither.
We'll hear from you soon.
Okay, thanks very much.
We welcome our maven on Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, I was with a group of shlichim, representatives from Israel, from all around the country. They'll be on the show in not too long, that you brought over. And we were talking about what's the best way to connect people with Israel. What's the most important thing you could do? And everybody said all at once, go to Israel. So let's talk about what it means to have a mission to Israel, to go to Israel, to visit Israel. Lots of American Jews have never been. Lots of American non-Jews have never been to Israel. And that's, you know, kind of too bad. Let's get them there.
You know, I kind of think that more than it is important for people to connect with Israel, going to Israel helps people connect with their own identity. When, especially for Jewish people, when you land in Israel and you hear Hebrew all around you, and you go out of the street and the taxi driver speaks Hebrew with you, and when you go on Shabbat in Jerusalem, and suddenly there's silence. Everybody goes to the synagogue because Jerusalem is relatively more observant. It gets a twist. And when you walk through the corridors of Jerusalem, and you think, hey, that's the same steps that King David walked through. I'm walking on the same path. When you drive up north to the Galilee and suddenly you think, well, all of our Torah took place here. This is the place. Those are the same views, the same mountains, the same trees, and, you know, maybe even the same animals that go around. So it's a very, I don't know if only spiritual, it's a very deep experience. One interesting aspect that many Jewish teens shared with me after coming back from trips in Israel is the feeling that suddenly you belong. Many of them, when they are here in the States or in Europe, in other places, they have this feeling of being alone, being the only Jewish kid in the class, being a part of a small group in the high school or in the university. Suddenly they come to Israel, they feel part of a peoplehood. I think that is a very important element of traveling to Israel.
You know, it's fascinating. As you know, I was in Israel just a couple of weeks ago on this foreign ministry trip, but it was a 3 or 4 day experience of being in Israel. That's a fast turnaround. I have to say, as soon as you get there, you just feel completely energized. Probably my 12th or 13th trip to Israel. Go for a run in Jerusalem. It's not like it anywhere else. You just feel that amazing connection to the land. Even if you've never been there, you can feel at home.
Yeah, you know, and it's not only seeing it on the news or in a film. You smell the smell. You taste the flavor. You feel. You go to the market and you argue with the sellers about how much is the tomato. It's fun. It's really fun.
And it's got an incredible energy. You know, what you see on the news, people say, oh, is it safe there? You know, I remember I walked home an hour and a half from 11 p.m. to 12:30 all the way across the middle of Jerusalem when I was there not long ago. Never felt in the least worried. I dare you to try that in any American city.
So go to Israel.
Go to Israel. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar in Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, who was just again named a semifinalist for the National James Beard Award for Chef of the Year.
That's right. Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Good morning and mazel tov. What's cooking at Janos now?
Well, all sorts of fun things. It's springtime, so this is when my restaurants come into their own, when we get all the new flavors from the gardeners, from baby beets to little peas to citrus. Wonderful things for us to cook with. The menus are light. They're fun. We're doing our 10 Terrific Taste menu year-round now at Janos, which is actually a misnomer. It's 12 different things over 4 courses. Lots of little mouthfuls of great tastes.
You know, my wife Wendy calls your food magic food.
That's so nice of her to say that. If I cook magic food, the place I do it is at Janos. That's where we pull out all the stops, and that's where it's really, that's the height of the cooking that I do.
What's the phone number for Janos?
615-6100.
Or www.janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, there are anti-circumcision measures on the ballot in San Francisco and maybe in Santa Monica and others being contemplated in California. That's disturbing for those of us who care deeply about Judaism and covenant and community, but it's also seems to me a little bit of a piece with the anti-Kashrut stuff going on in Europe and New Zealand. What are your impressions on this?
Well, first of all, more disturbing than a measure on the ballot, because in a free society, presumably any type of measure can be put to the vote, is some of the propaganda and the publicity being used in the campaign, which includes horrific anti-Semitic caricatures, really reminiscent of Hitler and his era, and not what one would expect to find in a state as liberal and theoretically open-minded as California. What I find interesting about this, though, is not so much, I mean, all kinds of nutty initiatives make it onto the ballots all over the U.S. This is of concern to the Jewish community because it, attacks something or threatens a practice that is really central to Judaism. I mean, one of the earliest commandments, one of the earliest orders that God gives to Abraham is circumcise your son and your manservants and everybody in your household. And anybody who's not circumcised is cast out of Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, and even people who practice very little else in terms of traditional Judaism, usually care to get their sons circumcised. What I find interesting, though, from the perspective that we usually talk about, which is the international Jewish scene, if this appeared on the ballot in France, everybody all over America would be screaming, ah, proof that France is anti-Semitic, all the French are anti-Semitic. Now, no one, or at least no sane person, is interpreting this measure on the ballot in San Francisco as proof that all Americans are anti-Semitic, or that the American government is anti-Semitic, or that this is an anti-Semitic society. And just to return for a second to this theme of, you know, are all these other countries that we like to think of as anti-Semitic really so bad? Part of the recent scandal involving Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the IMF, was that he was widely acknowledged to be the most likely victor in the next French presidential elections. And everybody in France knows he's Jewish, and nobody raised that as a problem or an objection at all. So France was about to elect a Jewish president, something this country is still far from doing.
Thanks, Tom. Interesting observation, interesting connection, and we will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish is a Public Service. The old rabbi lies in the hospital, barely conscious, surrounded by worried congregants. What a great speaker. His sermons were so inspiring, says one. The best rabbi ever, agrees another, a great fundraiser. He took such good care of his family. He always had time for them, no matter how busy he was, says another. And what a brilliant teacher. He could patiently explain the Torah, the Talmud, everything to anyone, no matter how hard the text or how ignorant the student. And a community leader, too. He was the best. Finally, everyone falls sadly silent. After a few moments of calm, the rabbi weakly opens one eye and says, and about my modesty, you say nothing? That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week our portion Korach features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. In last week's Parsha, the people of Israel arrived at the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies came back with a poor report. We aren't strong enough to conquer the land. That lack of faith lay at the heart of the problem, and God decided that this generation could never come into the Holy Land, would have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they were all gone, and a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth and untainted by slavery and that mentality, could come forward. Stung by the sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Levite named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. Born into the same tribe as Moses, Korach is an insider, rebelling against his own kin. Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us, he asks. He claims that they have arrogated to themselves powers that should truly belong to the people. In their place, he proposes placing a much more democratically appointed dictator, himself, to lead the people. Korach's fake populist rebellion threatens the very foundation of the Israelite leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, we might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery, as some Israelites propose now to do. But Korach dissembles. He lies about Moses' own motivations. Moses clearly has had no great desire for high office, but he has held it as a sacred trust given by God. In rebellion, Korach threatens not Moses' authority, but God's. Our Torah portion tells us that in order to determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor display is conducted, and the net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed by God, and Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. It's always nice when God steps in and backs you up with force. But the abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, which is focused solely on personal gain or power politics, will fail. Only through faith, dedication to ideals, and devotion to the higher purposes of Jewish ethics and meaning can we reach our own promised land. When we come back on Too Jewish, Sarah Weiss Maoudi of the Foreign Ministry of Israel tells us what's legal and what's not when people try to come into your country by sea, say in a flotilla-style invasion. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
This is Rabbi Jason Holtz with the News of Jews. On Tuesday, June 14th, Rabbi Richard Jacobs was officially elected as president of the Union for Reform Judaism, also known as the URJ. The URJ is the umbrella organization of all Reform congregations in North America. In his acceptance speech, Rabbi Jacobs outlined several goals for his presidency in the Reform movement. He noted that many recent demographic studies show that at any given time, only about half of American Jews are affiliated with a synagogue. Reform Judaism must be a leader in reaching out to unaffiliated Jews and bringing them into warm, welcoming, and dynamic communities. He said, quote, "Everywhere we look, there are dramatic challenges facing our people. Yet each is a phenomenal opportunity to revitalize Jewish life. Only very rarely has Jewish history known an era of so much creativity or innovation. No previous generation has possessed our resources and potential." End quote. Rabbi Richard Jacobs also spoke about his commitment to Israel. He states that when he says, "Israel is important to me," he means it in the same way saying, "My heart is important to me." He goes on to say that, "Both are deep inside of me, and I cannot imagine living without either." Rabbi Jacobs has received some criticism for affiliating with left-leaning Israeli political organizations. While he did not speak to his own political stances on Israel during his acceptance speech, he did say, "When the time comes for such a debate, that it will be machloket l'shem shamayim, a dispute for the sake of heaven, that we will conduct that debate with passion to be sure. I hope and pray we will always debate with passion, but with civility and a respect for those who hold differing views." Rabbi Jacobs concluded his acceptance speech by laying out a vision for the future of Reform Judaism. He said, "In 25 years, I see our movement flourishing with a wide network of energetic religious communities of depth and passion stretching throughout the Jewish world. From the ranks of the unaffiliated and the uninspired, they will flock to our inclusive religious communities that are serious about learning, spirituality, tikkun olam, and community. Together we will catalyze innovation and excellence so that our expression of Judaism will attract the widest cross-section of 21st century Jews and seekers who have yet to find their faith. Remember, congregations with purpose and imagination can do great things." I'm Rabbi Jason Holtz, and this is the News of Jews.
Our brothers, our brothers, the sons.
We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish Art guests this morning, Sarah Weiss-Mahudi. She's the senior assistant, the legal advisor in the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Israel. Foreign Affairs is responsible for all of Israeli foreign policy. And in this case, the legal issues involving blockading Gaza were what we were talking about earlier. We'll talk about a couple of other interesting legal issues. You mentioned that it's perfectly legal to set up a blockade. What are the specific rules for when you can blockade an enemy? And there are like laws and treaties and all kinds of things on this, right?
One good source to look at, if you want to get a view of what the customary law obligations are, that means the binding obligations, is the San Remo Manual. It's basically a restatement of what law applies to armed conflict at sea. You could also take a look at some of the major naval manuals, the U.S. manual, British manual, German manual, to get...
So for all of our listeners who have those on their shelves, time to pull them down.
You can actually Google them. They're all available on the web for free. But if you take a look, you can sort of walk through what the requirements are, because certainly you can't just say, well, there's a legal blockade. In effect, you have to meet certain legal tests for the blockade to be legal. So the first would be a test of notice. Did you give proper notice of the blockade? Because certainly if others aren't aware of it, they wouldn't have an obligation to know about it. So that would be the first thing.
If you don't know there's a blockade, then you can't observe the blockade.
Exactly. And, okay. You need to know where it is, etc.
How many miles out it goes, where the borders of it are.
Exactly. The second thing would be that you need to impose it in an effective manner, meaning you can't just sort of be on certain days the blockade is in effect, certain days it's not in effect. You would also need to impose the blockade in a non-discriminatory manner. Meaning you can't just let certain vessels of a certain flag in and certain vessels of a certain flag out. You really need to impose it without discriminating.
On everybody.
Now, another requirement is that you can't block access to neutral ports and coasts. This is really important because you need to allow particularly neutral vessels to be able to go to neutral ports, to unload their goods, to refuel, etc. You can't use it as a method for really affecting international maritime commerce. So that would be another requirement. The last requirement is you can't use it to starve the civilian population. You can't use the maritime blockade if its sole purpose is to starve the civilian population. You can't use it to deny what's called essential objects to the civilian population.
So food, medical supplies?
Exactly. Under international humanitarian law, the laws of armed conflict, there are certain minimums that at all times must be adhered to, meaning that when involved in armed conflict, you must ensure that the civilians on both sides have access to minimum raft of humanitarian goods, and that the humanitarian needs, the essential humanitarian needs on both sides are met, and the civilians have access to vital goods. And I would say in the case of Israel, we certainly do this. For example, on the eve of the 2010 Turkish flotilla incident, there were 14,000 tons of civilian goods going into Gaza. We set up...
On a weekly basis. Okay, sorry.
Now, there were alternative land corridors that were set up to ensure that the humanitarian requirements were met. These are called... The San Remo Manual mentions that you can set up technical arrangements. And indeed, our land corridors are those technical arrangements that ensure that humanitarian needs are being met. And again, we don't get down to the red lines. We try to maintain something above and beyond
bare minimums.
And so that's the way that we ensure. But it's not just that Israel sort of checks itself. We have a number of mechanisms in place to make sure that we're meeting those requirements. Our Supreme Court is a very activist Supreme Court, and there are several cases that go to the Supreme Court to make sure the challenge, are we meeting those humanitarian requirements? If we're not, then the Supreme Court would send us back to the drawing board. In the case of Gaza, it has been affirmed that Israel indeed meets its humanitarian requirements. We just recently had also a public panel that investigated the May 2010 Turkish flotilla incident, and one of its conclusions, particularly after seeing the testimony, hearing the testimony of human rights groups in Israel, was that indeed there is no starvation in the Gaza Strip. Currently, we're talking about roughly 24,000 tons weekly of humanitarian goods going into Gaza, again, by these accepted land corridors that all legitimate organizations use, the UN and other human rights groups.
NGOs,
they use that. And all the protesters who've wanted to come to Gaza have been told time and again that if they are to use those accepted land corridors, then certainly all humanitarian goods, so long as they're legitimate goods and not munitions or contraband, those will go directly to the civilians.
There's sort of a weird situation here. Israel is technically in an armed conflict with Hamas, but access to Gaza is almost completely through Israel, with the exception of the border with Egypt.
So. I think that's a point that sort of gets sort of glossed over. You know, when a finger is pointed to Israel, we do have to remember that, first of all, that Israel, it's not that Israel can choke off Gaza. Gaza has a border with Egypt. And I think we have to remember that, and sort of our focus has to be sort of a wider approach in terms of just what goes on. Then in terms of the relationship with Gaza, again, in 2005, Israel implemented what is known as its disengagement plan. Israel pulled out all of its settlements.
Sharon pulled out of Gaza, is how it's usually
all
understood.
Of its military. Right. And what was left with, though, there's the problem that Hamas still controls Gaza, and that Hamas continues to aim rockets at our civilians who live in Israel proper around the perimeter of Gaza. In the last decade, there have been over 6,000 rocket attacks on our civilians. Again, we're talking about living in legitimate cities and towns that are not controversial in Israel proper. If you believe that there should be a Jewish state in any configuration, they are living in
Israel,
area.
Clearly. Not an occupied anything.
Not an occupied anything. And so there's a whole question about, and certainly any country that deals with terrorism and how to deal with terrorism and that asymmetric warfare where you have one side, Israel, who abides by the rule of law and international law, and the other side that throws those laws, in the garbage can and really, no one has the exact answer of how you're supposed to deal with it. We try to implement policies that are in line with international law, that are a proper response. So no country can tolerate rockets being fired on its civilians. No country can tolerate that we have to close down schools and that yellow school buses have rockets fired down them. And I think no one would say that international law doesn't have an answer for that. I think that as an international lawyer, our job is to find What are the answers? I think the answer, international law would never say, just roll over and play dead. But with that said, of course, the whole dealings with how you deal with terrorist organization, there are many, many dilemmas, exactly how you fight against an organization that hides behind civilians and how you fight in dense urban areas. And the traditional rules of international law were that both sides wore uniforms and you had legitimate... Yeah,
Geneva conventions don't really help very much,
and
do they?
And it's a big problem. It's a big problem how we deal with these organizations and how do they fit into international law, where everything used to fit into nice, neat boxes.
Or supposedly did.
Or supposedly did. Exactly.
I have two more questions. I'll try to make them brief. Term that's been used that I've heard at this conference we're speaking in, lawfare. Explain what that is.
Basically, what lawfare is a way to sort of use seemingly legitimate legal mechanisms, be it in various international legal fora and international courts, and try to sort of drag Israel into these very political lawsuits as a way of sort of blackening Israel's name and calling into question Israel's legitimacy, and particularly calling into the question, does Israel abide by the rule of law? And a lot of these lawsuits are basically not so much to win. I don't think They're designed to win cases. They're designed to bring attention and bring very political matters into the courtroom to basically create a it's another front for the PR campaign against Israel. And it's something that we're seeing more and more. I would say certainly the Goldstone report was sort of a maybe one of the landmark the spotlight focused on just what lawfare is. It's really calling into question Israel's legal system and our legal views, even though these are things that we take very, very seriously. And sort of particularly when you think of Israel as just fighting against so many voices that are trying to find each corner to sort of corner Israel, and the courtroom is certainly not immune. And that is exactly what lawfare is in a nutshell. I mean, a lot of times comes another sort of example of lawfare would be like, a seemingly legitimate organization. I use them as often as an example, the Human Rights Council of the UN, which human rights, well, everyone likes human rights. That's a good thing. But that's a council that is so politicized that something more than three quarters of its resolutions are about Israel, even though you have places in the world like Sudan or like Libya. And they come out with a report
which violate human rights all the time on a constant basis.
Yeah. And you come out with a report against a very anti-Israel report that sort of presumes Israel's guilt from the get-go. But then someone waves that report in your face, and as a representative of Israel, you have to deal with that and delegitimizing that, and it's a very difficult battle to win.
The last question is. Israel is, as a lawyer and as a representative of Israel, Israel has a fascinating and I think very successful legal system. Just talk about it briefly.
Well, in a nutshell, I think if I wanted to point at just one element of Israel's legal system, I would certainly point at our Supreme Court, which is something we can be very proud of. As opposed to in the U.S., where really the Supreme Court is reserved for certain really landmark cases that they pick and choose every year, Israel's Supreme Court is open to everyone, citizens and non-citizens alike. And it's not only a court of appeal, it's also our constitutional court. And basically, even in real time, anyone can go and appeal to the Supreme Court if they feel that their basic rights, their constitutional rights, their human rights have been abused. And our Supreme Court is quite brave, and we've had some really landmark cases, even cutting-edge cases before everyone was there. I'll give you an example. There was a landmark case about torture years back where the state's attorney's office was trying to argue that in certain cases where they're doing interrogations, certain physical pressure could be applied if you have someone who they termed a ticking bomb, a detainee who really had information that you felt you could get out. And there's been this debate around the whole Bin Laden thing, how much torture was used. But our Supreme Court came out and said no to our security services. No, you cannot use torture.
Ever.
Even against the most,
heinous
terrorist, you can't use torture in an interrogation. That is not allowed because international law doesn't allow it. And I think cases like that, there's been cases where our security fence has been rerouted because our Supreme Court has come and said, listen, we have to take into account the needs of the population. And yes, Israel has legitimate security needs, but you need to balance that. And they've sent us back, state attorneys have sent us back to the drawing table.
I want to thank Sara Weiss Mahudi for a great visit. She is with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Jerusalem. And if you ever have a legal question that you need an answer for on Israel's behalf, she's the one to call. Thanks so much, Sara.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Temple Emanuel's Olga and Bob Strauss Early Childhood Education Center is proud to announce the addition of a full-day kindergarten beginning in the fall of 2011. Registration is now underway. Call 325-0390. The Strauss Early Childhood Education Center is an award-winning, NAICS-accredited school for young children with an outstanding reputation for educational excellence and individual attention. Located on the campus of historic Temple Emanuel next to the Biblical Garden, kindergarten includes a fully integrated secular and Judaic curriculum that surpasses all state standards with an emphasis on emergent education. Full-day kindergarten class is taught by the school's most experienced and celebrated teacher, Cindy Sadowski. Registration for 2011-2012 is underway. For more information about the kindergarten and to register, contact Lynn Henry at 520-325-0390. 325-0390 for the Strauss Early Childhood Education Center and kindergarten. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Cantor Nancy Abramson, head of the Jewish Theological Seminary's Cantorial Program, which produces most of the conservative movement's cantors. Our playout this morning comes from, well, Barbara Streisand for Father's Day, the very schmaltzy Papa, Can You Hear Me? There's a new version out there from the cast of Glee, believe it or not, which also has lots of Jews in it, but, well, this one is still better. My friends, have a happy Father's Day and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me? Papa, can you find me in the night? Are you near me? Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you help me not be frightened?
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emanuel.